I am Sean O'Hara. I'm the director of the Honolulu Museum of Art. Times have changed since I was a boy in Hawaii. When I was growing up, a lot of the wealth was owned by very few people. And that's just the sort of historical situation from the 19th century. And since then, land has been purchased by people who live here, and changes have been made, and each generation that passes, there are many more descendants, and so wealth becomes divided even further. A lot of those entities and families were the big supporters of the cultural institutions in Hawaii, and now that things have changed, and wealth has been sort of distributed around differently. It means that the way institutions are supported is different. As each generation, develops, there are more people.
So the wealth is divided
up. Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, you just have to approach it differently. You have to, you have to have many more donors, and you can't have a system that relies on just a few people.
What is the potential for giving in this community today?
Well, as things have changed and the wealth has been distributed differently, I don't think it's very seemly to have an institution that is considered elitist. It can have an elite mission, like presenting the finest works of art or the finest music or the finest musicians to an audience, but I don't think that we can promote things as being exclusive. I don't think that in today's society is particularly attractive to people.
Have you had to change your mission at all, given that you've got to appeal to a much broader range of people?
No, not necessarily. What's fortunate about the Honolulu Museum of Art is that we've always been a global institution representing all cultures. So we've never really been exclusive in that respect.
What has changed with the changing, giving structure?
Well, with the giving structure, let me back up. Museums have changed in that around the turn of the millennium, particularly with the advent of the internet, there has been a sort of democratization, if I can use that word, of education, and that's resulted in people no longer emphasizing art and culture from the past, but addressing art and culture and issues of the present. And it's no longer the canon that's presented by the establishment that people are interested in. It's the issues that they come up with themselves. And so that has actually changed museums enormously and the way they present their art. So, for example, where you might go into a museum in the past and be presented with Roman art and Greek art and Egyptian art, and then kind of move up the centuries to the present day, I think a lot of museums now present contemporary art when you walk in through the doors, because that's the art that people want to see first, and they expect to see it. And they find very little connection with ancient art.
Yeah, I find that true.
Yeah, it sort of mirrors the shift of education when we used to all study Shakespeare, and now we're reading novels written yesterday.
Yeah.
A number of the great museums had what they called the 40-year rule, which was an artist had to be dead for 40 years before they could present that person's work. Part of that it was allowing history to judge the person and to judge their impact on the wider community and the wider art world. And also it allowed people to find out more about the artists because, you know, it's only when people are dead do a lot of secrets come out. And there's it's very complicated when you're dealing with artists who are living because they're living and their friends are living. So I think there was that's the way museums had presented art in the past. But now people demand art of the present, and so museums have changed significantly in the last 20 or so years.
Yeah, I guess I do. I see that without even noticing it. Yeah, that.
Yeah, I knew a professor at Yale who said that what he found interesting in the past, few years was that. Students are no longer interested in doing research in, you know, Baroque art or ancient Egyptian art. What they're interested in is art that can be exclusively researched online, which for the most part means that they are doing projects in art created in the last couple decades.
I don't know if there's any ultimate good related to that kind of shift.
Yeah.
So for a museum, how do you make sure that you have the exhibitions that will appeal?
Well, that's what we're working on right now. We have changed the way we go about our planning so that we are able to bring in more voices into the planning process. And we bring in our people from marketing and people from our commercial side to also weigh into projects that come in. In the past, and this is a very traditional way of doing it, we would generate a lot of ideas from our various curatorial departments, and oftentimes these ideas would be created without input from other departments, which is entirely natural because the system was sort of created that way. But what we've changed since I arrived was a process by which we include all of the key departments in that decision, and so that kind of informs the eventual outcome. And the hope is that the exhibitions and the projects that come out of it are more attractive from many viewpoints.
How so they're the not able to work stuff, because marketing and education are so closely tied. Marketing, education, and curation.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the marketing staff are involved in the beginning of the process, but they have a different setup. They report directly to me because I see marketing as an area that has to be at the beginning of the conversation, not the end of the conversation. And so the marketing and communications folks need to take the ideas in a raw state in order to be able to process and choose the ideas that need to be communicated. And then also inform the people who are devising these ideas, like me, and advising us on audience needs and say the needs of the press and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to make sure that the process is informed from the very beginning. And you know, it kind of goes. It's kind of an interesting analogy with the. With the artist communities that you asked about. You know, I see this organization as a family of people who are all working towards a common goal. You know, they're essentially paddlers in the same canoe, right? You all have to paddle in the same direction. Well, in terms of the artist groups and arts community in Hawaii, you know, we're all on an island. We're not going to get away from each other anytime soon. We have limited resources. We have limited options because, again, we're on an island, right? We have fewer things that we can do compared to if we were a community on a continent. So, therefore, I feel that we should all paddle in the same direction, and we have to coordinate our plans together. We can't sort of each go our own way or compete with each other openly, because there are limited resources. It just won't work. You'll have a scenario where the island eats itself.
That's kind of happening. But are we competing with each other for the same resources?
We are because we don't plan anything.
How could
planning
we plan?
How could planning be done?
How would we plan for this?
Well, we would first of all talk to each other, and then we would pick a time in the future that we can imagine what we all want to be when we grow up.
You mean
like the state of Hawaii?
What is institutions? Let's just go cultural institutions here, because I'm really worried about.
We ought to be because I always feel that Hawaii is always one step away from being a Puerto Rico. we have limited resources. If we don't do it right, we can be. I grew up in Hawaii in the 70s, 80s. I've seen it. Hawaii was not an easy place. The recession in the 90s was not kind to Hawaii. But that's because we tethered our future to Japan, and that was going in a different direction, and the rest of America was going in a different direction. So that's why we ended up the way we did. But we can't put all our musubis in one basket, right? We have to come up with an intelligent, diversified strategy because we don't have that many choices. We have to really do it right.
What could that look like? I mean, do I have to ask first,
Where
is the money here?
Oh, where is the money? The money has to be with the wealthy people, for example, who live here some of the time, all the time. The local population doesn't have a lot of money because
we live here.
Yeah, and the cost of living is so incredibly high. In fact, it's horrible. It's totally horrible. It's not twice as much to live here. In some cases, it's five times as much. I mean, but I would say that we have a lot of great things about living here, which is why we're all here, and I think ultimately it comes down to our people. It's not so much the weather, because the weather is now a little more extreme than it was in the past. We have rising sea levels, so that's not helpful. We have the fog, which we never talk about, and we're also the most expensive city in the United States of America. So it's not going to be an easy place to
get money
promote.
Out of people.
Yeah.
Well, how are we going to do that?
I think that we have to have a limited number of organizations. We have to live within our means. We have to determine what that is. We have to live within our means, and we have to coordinate everything we're doing. It's like as you would if you planned your household. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it is as simple as that. You don't just grow Kapakahi style. You plan it out. You determine what your resources are, and then you determine what you can do within those resources.
So say that a group of arts organizations, a community arts organizations, got together, looked at the landscape of potential giving here, and could this group of
Well,
approach
here's,
a problem like this
here's,
together?
Here's what I think. Possibly, but that's often doesn't work that way.
No,
I would say this, though. What you want to do is you want to have an organization, whether it's a state planning organization or a private organization or whatever it is.
Or an individual.
Sort of, or an individual.
Organization like yours.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Determine the amount of wealth out there and project it out 20, 30 years, and then determine how many organizations that would support. And then you have an answer. And then you compare it to the reality, and you find out, do we have twice as many organizations as the landscape would support? And if that's the case, you either I don't know, coordinate it all, or you wish everyone good luck and you see what happens.
Wait, so there must be philanthropic, you know, information out there, right? The what we could expect to be given by certain people, certain kinds of people,
yeah,
with certain...
Oh, amounts. I'm sure. I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's a certain amount of data out there.
Is there any idea how much wealth is here? Available wealth? What would,
oh,
what
I'm sure for? I haven't... I don't know what that I don't know what that number is, but
what would that be called? I mean,
but you know what's interesting? But I have to say one thing though. There's a difference between what's out there and what we can get, because you know, in recent surveys, we were at the bottom of the list in terms of charitable giving in the U.S.
The Hawaii was at the bottom of the list.
Yeah. Yeah, if you look at the Giving Tuesday or whatever that philanthropy day was, they looked at it and they found Hawaii was 50 out of 50 in some of the major areas. So, you know, there could be a lot of wealth here, but we're not going to necessarily get it.
What's your strategy going to be?
Well, the strategy that we're following is, A, we have to be a relevant, popular institution, and then we have to prove that we're a sustainable, effective model. And then we appeal to those people who feel that cultural institutions are important to support. And I would say this, is, you know, going back to the idea that it's very hard for us to compete in the global market, particularly for tourism, in that, you know, again, you know, there are a lot of places with nice weather, Phuket, South Africa, I mean, you name so many, and they're significantly cheaper. And also, I think a lot of the tourism isn't about, you know, getting a sunburn on the beach anymore. So I think because of that, we have to look at what we have natural opportunities in, and that's primarily our people. And the fact that we're a multicultural society with now, you know, fabulous, interesting offerings in food and music and culture. And I think that's what we have to promote, because, you know, ultimately we're an island and the natural resources are limited. So we're going to have to rely on the people. And I think that, you know, that translates to you know, performing arts, that translates into culinary arts, that translates into museums and visual arts. That's what we can compete on. And I think a lot of tourists, particularly from East Asia, are cultural tourists, which we know spend 7-8 times more than what a normal tourist does. So we know that numbers. And really, as a state, we need to be promoting our culture and our people, and not necessarily just the beaches. I find that a really simplistic, old world strategy, which won't pay off, because we can't compete on price and we can't compete on weather.
For the museum, do you still see that kind of structure, that support structure of a third third coming from what, grants? Or?
Oh, yeah, so a third from revenues, a third from our endowment, and a third from giving, from donations.
Donations, endowment,
and
revenues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you still kind of see that?
Roughly. I mean, it would be, I would like to increase more on the revenue and endowment side, because I'd like to have a model which funds us at 130%, not 100%. Right? It's called growth. You want to earn more than you're spending. And it's a natural tendency, even for people. You know, it's why so many lottery winners go bankrupt, right? They suddenly have $100 million, and what, 10 years later they're bankrupt? Well, guess what? They increased their spending. They didn't live at the rate that they had lived before. You know? To quote Steve Bannon, he was recently interviewed, and he said, Goldman Sachs teaches you one thing: don't invent stuff. Just take something that works and make it better. I think we often aren't able to do that in Hawaii because we can't see other institutions in other states. Mm-hmm. Personally, you know, you have to travel there.
It doesn't apply because we're us.
Yeah, right. Whereas when I was living on the mainland, you were always benchmarking yourself against neighboring states, neighboring institutions all the time. It was nonstop, and you were visiting other institutions because you could. You get in the car, and 2 hours later, you're in another state with another institution. What's wonderful about Hawaii is we're an island. What's difficult about Hawaii is we're an island. and so that's why it's important to bring in as many ideas from elsewhere, so that we can learn from those ideas. I mean, museum is not going to come up with original ideas. It should really take ideas from other institutions and other museums and employ those. At least those ideas have track records. I mean, I'm staying the obvious, you know, throughout this entire discussion, but...
I guess.
I mean, it should be obvious.
Do you anticipate any changes in giving or any changes as a result of changes in tax laws?
Well, I'm not entirely sure about the effects on the tax laws because it's so unusual that it's kind of hard to see what that result is. But I don't think it's going to change things that quickly. Having said that, I mean, because of the fear of the changes in the tax laws, we did receive certain donations sooner rather than later just to make sure that... nothing changes in the future that prevents that from happening, you know, particularly in the world of art. Our 100th anniversary is in 2027, so that's going to happen, hell or high water, you know. That's not going to change, and we have to know what we want to be as an institution when that incredible anniversary comes up, because I see that as the great opportunity of our lifetime.
Are boards different? What is your board like?
Well, I think boards are different in that they don't represent the old establishment that Hawaii used to be. I think they're bringing in more people from diverse backgrounds, more people who have mainland backgrounds, more local people who have lived and worked on the mainland have come back here to run businesses, for example. I think boards are more full of professional people who work. I think, you know, it's just, they just reflect the nature of the changing society that we have. You know, in the olden days, you know, women wouldn't work, and only men would work for the most part. And now women work, so now we have professional women on our boards, and I think that's, of course, a good thing, and because our boards need to eventually, if they don't now, they need to reflect the population and the audience that we serve. And that's the argument for corporate boards being representative. Because if they ultimately lead the organization, they need to understand who their audience is. I find a lot of people who've moved from the mainland here have a very rosy perspective of Hawaii because they've chosen it naturally and they think it's a great place and fine. But I think a lot of the people who were kids here do have a pretty balanced approach. I mean, they don't think it's all paradise. they understand that there's the good and the bad, and when you have a more objective view of the situation, you come up with better solutions. I mean, I came here with a healthy amount of fear because I've seen venerable organizations go down, like the Honolulu Symphony, for example. You know, the oldest symphony west of the Mississippi. I was kind of traumatized by that, but it also taught me the fact that what stops any organization from going down? Nothing. So we have to come up with better models. More sustainable models.
And that model right now is to diversify your support?
Absolutely. You have to diversify your revenue stream. Yeah. So support, revenues, endowments, you have to make sure that you're not heavily reliant on one or the other. I've seen the richest institutions in the world fire people because they were heavily relied on their endowments, and then the markets go down, and guess what? They just don't have the money to pay the salaries. So it's you know, you having a big endowment is fantastic, but just make sure you're not heavily relying on it. And then the other thing is, as I mentioned before, make sure that you're not spending exactly the amount you take in. You know, make sure that you're taking in more than you're spending, which is very difficult. I know it sounds obvious, but it's difficult to get organizations to understand that they should not be spending, you know, the amount that they take in. You know, we're, you know, as a state, we're one tweet away from having a disastrous economy, right? You know. North Korea just has to do something crazy and we're in trouble. So we have to have as diversified a situation as possible. We can't just be relying on just tourism or just, you know, endowment or just revenue. I mean, the good thing about the situation we are in Hawaii is that we have very limited options. That's a good thing. It means we don't agonize over the solution. It means actually we can probably all agree in one form or another. Mm-hmm. Because there aren't that many options.
We can all agree on the same limited options. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There are limited options, and so we just choose the ones that make the most sense. Yeah. And going back to those options, I am convinced that the biggest of those options is our people. Our people are our greatest strength. It's not going to be our beaches. It's not going to be our weather. It's not going to be our water supply. It's not going to be our, you know, it's not going to be a lot of things, but it's definitely going to be our people. You know, we're the most diverse state in the U.S. and we're one of the most diverse populations in the world. That's a natural advantage that we have over any other population. We should use it.
You said that Hawaii is so different, and it's not like anywhere else for someone who's coming in, maybe as an administrator.
Oh, I think it's.
How is it different?
Most different place I can possibly imagine.
How? Why?
How is it different?
A lot of places are provincial in their own.
Well, first of all, we don't have any majority population, so that's interesting. I don't know of any place that doesn't have a majority population anywhere. We have an incredibly diverse population. I can't think of any place that has so many types of people from all over the world.
But New York does. They don't happen to be from Asia, but they've got incredible diversity.
Well, New York City,
Africa and the Caribbean that we don't have.
Well, they do, but aren't most people in New York either black or white?
I don't know.
Really? I think that's the case. I don't know. Or I mean in my travels on mainland United States, you see mostly one type of person.
I know.
In Hawaii, you can't. Here, you don't.
Here, people would say, aren't people almost all white or Asian? Yeah, they are.
Yeah, but what does Asian mean? You know. Yeah. What does white mean? Yeah, yeah. You know. And I'm comparing in my mind what Hawaii was like up until 1986, and starting in 2017. And so it's a really interesting comparison because it's kind of like yesteryear. You know what I mean? 1986 was almost closer to 1886 in Hawaii. You know what I mean? Right? I mean, people didn't own land. People, you know, it was like really segregated. I mean, it was a really different sort of place then. You know, if you wanted a job, you work at the cannery, right? Or whatever, right? That doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't exist, right? And now you've got this whole new situation. It's very interesting, kind of, but a lot of the underlying aspects of Hawaii are still exactly the same. It's just that people don't know how to see them because they're not running this comparison like I do.
You know, now that you point that out, it seems as though the kinds of people who would be more open to coming to a museum, it would seem that their numbers would have increased since 1986. You know what I mean? Just the people who've...
Yeah. Well, but the other challenge that we face as a museum is that when I was growing up, there were only a handful of things you could ever do. Go to the zoo, go to the symphony, go to the ballet, go to the museum. I mean, there aren't that many things. Now, I mean, you could do 1,000 things from your bedroom. So this is why I like to say we're a museum of multidimensional experiences. Because you come and you can look at art and smell art and
hear
eat
the
food
fountains.
And hear the fountains. And yeah, it's, you know, for students who do a lot of their learning online, you know, it's important that they have human experiences where they come into contact with real things.
About the paintings you've got in your...
Oh, yeah.
Here. Okay, yeah. Let's see. Let's see.
Albers and Albers.
Yeah.
Chal Hassan.
Right.
Deben Korn. Delacroix.
Delacroix. Boy, it really looks like a Delacroix. Is that real?
No. Yeah. Now, what's interesting is Goyard is a quite important French female artist, and then this is an early Samidoy and a late Samidoy. and then this is Henry Rayburn, the great portraitist. So in the world of art, uh-huh. You know, beautiful women are at the top. You know, dogs. Young men, old men, and then old ladies are at the bottom of the value chain. But in my view, and in my business, old ladies are at the top of the value chain.
Tell me why.
Because this is the Dowager Countess of Boyne. These are the great patrons of the art community. So, if I can put it diplomatically, they're the ones who are left with the wealth, right?
Yeah.
All the men die off. All the women are running the show, and they own the wealth, they support you.
That's nice.
So I have it up just to remind you who my real target audience is. Probably you.
Yeah.